Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna
have a
Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.
We did. We burned many things we found. That was the beautiful, wonderful, fabulous Dar Williams singing with the great, late, great Pete Seeger. And David Burns, who wrote the lyrics to that Grammy-winning song, Solartopia. We're back for another hour of hot talk on in this world of Solartopia, green-powered Earth, healing and healing our planet, and healing our body politic. We got a great guest with us today. His name is Peter Matthews. He's actually going to be introducing me at a public speaking event in Los Angeles in a week or so. Peter's been a college and university professor, political science at Cypress College, taught at Cal State Fullerton, and has his own radio show, actually, Heads On at KEIBAM. He has written a killer book called Dollar Democracy with Justice, with Liberty and Justice for Some, How to Claim the American Dream for All. Peter Matthews, welcome to us.
Hi.
Peter, are you there?
Excellent.
You are there. You're in California.
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
And the studio is in New York, the wonders of modern technology. Tell us a bit, Peter, about this book you've written, Dollar Democracy. We got a whole hour to go through it. You had a lot of really good stuff in there. I won't say meaty. It's tofu-y, let's put it that way. Your opening quote on the you're in California, after all. The opening quote, politics is not about power. Politics is not about money. Politics is not about winning for the sake of winning. Politics is about the improvement of people's lives. That's U.S. Senator, the late, great U.S. Senator Paul Wellstone, a friend of mine. I miss him dearly. And I wonder what really happened to that airplane he was flying on. Here's another one from Michael Parenti. Peter Matthews provides us with stories of his personal activism, along with a cogent political analysis of what is happening to our country and our world. With clarity and courage, he fights against dollar democracy on behalf of real democracy. Well written and well informed, this book is a citizen's weapon. That's Michael Parenti, PhD from Yale University, author of Democracy for the Few, The Face of Imperialism and Waiting for Yesterday. Peter, it's a pleasure to have you on. And
it's a great honor to be here, Harvey, with you, a real pioneer for all these years that I've followed and admired and been inspired by. A lot of us have your work for environmental justice and environmental sustainability and social justice. Thanks for having
me. Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. And just for that, we'll give you the whole hour, which we were going to do anyway. And I look forward to being hosted by you and guested and introduced by you
in
Los Angeles, next week. So, Peter, tell us about this book. Tell us what the main message is, the main theme, and why and how you wrote it.
Well, the main thing is that the middle class in America, as everyone's been hearing, has been disappearing, and we've lost 10% of the middle class. It's shrunk by that much in just the last decade or so. And it's not just the middle class, the working poor and the working people in America who want to be able to realize the American dream, that is basically be able to earn a home, enough money for a home, to have children, the time with their children, to spend quality time with them, and to go on a little vacation. That security and that sense of happiness when things are fulfilled economically. And then you can move on to spiritual pursuits. That was the American dream, Harvey, and it's been taken away by these rich corporate elites who have bought the government, our U.S. government, members of Congress, and quite often the presidency and other administration officials are basically bought and paid for through campaign contributions and lobbying money, and they vote in favor of the top one-half of 1% and not of the regular folks to have an opportunity in life, not to mention other very important issues like sustainability, environment, to destroying our environment from big corporations, just polluting our rivers and our streams and our air without any regulation because of deregulation, because they bought it through campaign contribution and lobbying. That's what I'm talking about in the book, Harvey. That's an introduction to it, but it goes into a lot of other things too, as you probably have already read.
Sounds pretty radical to me. You sure not? You're one of them there Reds or commies or something?
You can call me whatever color you want, but I'm proud of what I believe in and what you believe in, because we believe in creating a better world, my friend, and a sustainable world. I mean, with what's going on in Fukushima, Harvey, which you're going to be talking about on the 14th, I've been talking about this. This is the number one issue. And yet we know how GE got to build that plant with very little regulation, putting on defective equipment that wore out, so, you know, with a tsunami territory with earthquakes. I mean, that had to have some money there influencing that decision, I would think. And from then on now, what are we doing now about it? We're just letting it pour, radiation in the ocean. There's a lot more to do, and there's a lot of the nuclear industry wants to restart all of its nuclear reactors again and keep the Saturn-Ofri going, which was shut down because of people power. So there's a lot of money chasing these politics in terms of our real health and the danger to our health as well as our economic well-being. So I'm really here to talk to you more about it as we go along here.
Well, let's start with the beginning here. Your book begins with you running for Congress. Is that correct?
Yes. That's right.
So tell us about that. Tell us what happened, and you got the nomination of the Democratic Party. Is that correct?
That's right. I won the nomination in 1994, and I ran against Steve Horn, who was a Republican.
Where was the district? What district?
District was Long Beach based, Long Beach and parts of Downey and Los Angeles, and it's a working class district right on the ocean as well. So environmental concerns were important, but Steve Horn was a so-called moderate Republican because he was pro-choice on abortion on that one issue. But he raised seven times the money that I did, and I refused to accept corporate money, just like Senator Wellstone, who, by the way, was also a friend of mine. I got to meet him. He came and spoke for me on this election. And we, in 1998, when I ran again, he spoke for me. And this time in 94, I won the nomination, went to Washington, D.C. to meet with the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and their leadership. And I was told, Peter Matthews, if you want to win, which I know you do, you only have to do three things: raise money, and get the money from whatever source you can get as long as it's legal. And I said, excuse me, but I don't take money from corporate lobbyists. I don't want to be bought off like many members of Congress. We want to make real change when we get in here. And the people at the leadership level of the party said, don't even think of that. And I said, what about Senator Wellstone? He did it without corporate money. He won by a couple of percent. He got reelected. And what they said to me was, don't even think of Senator Wellstone's example. He was a fluke. Mr. Matthews, don't campaign in areas where people of color live. They don't vote. Don't campaign in areas where students are located. They don't vote. Don't campaign among the renters. They don't vote. So just go out there and raise the money, and we'll do the targeted mailing. We'll get you expert advisors, and we'll get pollsters for you so we can get that vote out on election day by mailing, basically. That's what they did. And you know, I let them get away with that time to some extent, but I didn't take any corporate money, and we didn't do as well as we did the next time when I won the nomination in 1998 against Steve Horn. We gained a lot of percent by just sticking to our guns, being outspent 5-1 that time, you know, even more than the first time, and we still got 45% to Steve Horn's 52%, because we actually went to churches and spoke there. We went to college classes. We went door-to-door to all the communities, and the young people got involved and volunteer. And Steve Horn got 52%. I got 45% without the corporate money. So it can be done, but it's very difficult. As my book will give you, there are better alternatives as well as that one, too. We should ask every one of our politicians today running for office to kick the corporate habit and give up their money and run grassroots like Wellstone. But
well, why do you
that,
think
very
you
hard
lost?
To do.
Yeah. Why do you think you lost?
Why do you think that I lost?
Yeah.
Because at that time, you still had overwhelming amount of odds with Horn raising seven times the money as me and doing targeted mailing. We only had enough money for one or two mailings, and we went to those grassroots areas. And at the end, you've got to remind voters in the last 2 weeks to get out to vote. And unless you have a reserve army of labor like workers in the polling booths and polling areas, not the booths, like Wellstone, even then it's difficult to win because the other guy comes and just inundates the mailboxes with targeted mailing in California. Different messages, by the way, Harvey. You know the pernicious effects of that. All they do is take a poll, and they tell whatever subgroup of voters that want to hear certain messages, they only give them that message, and that's it. They don't talk about an overall plan for the country, for the area. They just talk about hitting, you know, women voters with just the pro-choice issue, the education issue, and that's about it. The blue-collar men, Catholic voters, hit them only with jobs problems. Don't even talk about the abortion choice issue to them. It's like a manipulated Madison Avenue campaigning that we've been having for the last 30 or 40 years. And both parties have engaged in it, and that's what's causing America to basically start this middle class to disappear here in this country and the country to lose its focus on real democracy.
So have that's you run again for Congress?
Right now I'm focusing on getting the message out about these social justice and issues that we have to address to save this country right now and to bring back that American dream for everyone. So I'm working on the education part, doing my radio program, writing this book. I've written several op-ed pieces in the local newspapers. So things are picking up right now. We just got a book review by Cam Williams that hit 300 newspapers across the country, thanks to my friend Eileen Proctor, who helped me get out there. So this idea is getting out there that we can win back the American dream and fairness and justice for all people here, and also for the people of the world. I mean, the United States is the big economy in the world that dominates so much of the world. We've got to get away from our imperialist policies, our neo-imperialism we've been pursuing all this time, and work towards social justice, you know, helping empower other countries' working people as well. And so therefore we have to get rid of free trade and go to fair trade, environmentally based standards raised by all those countries that come into our fair trade agreement. You've got to insist on higher labor standards and higher environmental standards and human rights standards before we let in other countries into a free trade zone. Instead, our corporate-dominated government has been supporting the corporate sector in Mexico, for example, and the elites in Guatemala and Honduras. And instead, we end up getting these corporations making huge amounts of money, and the elites in those countries also making money, and the working people on both sides of those borders suffering like crazy. So I'm here to try to get that message, as many people are doing it already. I mean, the public is becoming more and more aware of this, Harvey, as you know. And once this change occurs, then we'll talk about possibly going into office. But more importantly, as the great adage says, when the people lead, the leaders will follow. And that's what we've got to do, is build that social movement, Harvey, which you've been so much a part of for 30 years or more of your life. The social movements are what made this country great and changed things. So, you know, if we have to have an inside-outside strategy. The outside is the most important, to get the right people inside eventually and to hold hands with them in the government. But mostly important, the people outside on the grassroots level have to do this thing. And I'm working to move to amend also. We'll talk about that later on, to get the 28th Amendment, the Constitution. And we'll talk about that in detail. It'll remove corporate personhood and also declare that money's not speech. So that's the big social movement tool right now, the Move to Amend Coalition.
Well, tell us about that. Well, Move to Amend, I'm sure many of our listeners know what that is, but tell us about Move to Amend, what it is, yes, and why you're involved, please.
And I focused a lot on it in my eighth chapter. But what it is it started out with just a few people 4 years ago in a living room, and you know, and they got together and said, you know, the reason that the middle class is disappearing and democracy is fading because the corporations have bought our system. So we've got to go back to limiting the corporations' power, taking away their corporate personhood, which, by the way, was given to them in 1886 by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Southern Pacific Railroad versus Santa Clara decision, California decision, that said that corporations are natural persons with human rights, with natural rights like the right to free speech. Now it's the right to religion with the Hobby Lobby case. Giving corporations personhood was a crazy thing for the court to do, but there was big money behind that as well. Lobbying.
Well, but there is a question, yeah, of whether they actually did that in the decision or whether some clerk just kind of conspired to interpret it that way.
I think it was both. The intent was there, but the actual application was done through that kind of implementation part of it. Whatever it is, we're suffering from that decision, and have been suffering for close to 100 years now. And that has been a ruination of our country because corporations have been out of control with Citizens United, with the McCutcheon decision, as you know, and also with the Buckley versus Vallejo decision, money equals speech. So this amendment, 28th Amendment, which we call the We the People Amendment, put forth by the Move to Amend Coalition, made up of hundreds of organizations, progressive groups, as well as individuals, hundreds of thousands of individuals, about 420,000 individuals signed the petition. We have two members of the House who actually sponsored it in the House, and
who
about
are they?
80 co-sponsors.
Who are they?
They're from Wisconsin and Minnesota. I don't remember their names exactly, but those are progressive states. They're two Democrats, by the way, progressive Democrats. And that bill, I mean, that amendment, the constitutional amendment, has been introduced. Now we need to get all of the other folks to get aboard and get a two-thirds vote in each House to make it go on to the next stage, which is ratification by the states. So I'm really becoming a spokesperson along with David Cobb and others around the country. I'll start speaking in August, making a tour here of California, about this. And once we get that going and get it done, the two things it'll bring it. Money is not speech, and corporations are not natural persons and don't have free speech under the First Amendment. So that would really limit the power. It'll go back to where corporations were before that, when the states chartered the corporation under certain conditions. They could make profit, but only they have to have a public purpose as well. They could build canals or railroads, and they can charge fees, but they have to stop after getting a 12% profit. They would disband the corporation, and they have to reapply for a charter because the people control the corporation, and that's how it should be now. The corporation has become like a Frankenstein monster out of control, controlling the people and the government and the media. And this amendment will really help. It's also building a social movement along the way. to bring about the social justice.
Exactly. Do you have the language of the amendment that you can tell us,
It's in my book.
Exactly. It's in your book. So tell us what it is, and tell us exactly how
chapter
amendment would strip the corporations of personhood.
Yeah, I'm looking for chapter 8 here. Here we go. I'm getting to it, but basically it just says those two things, and it also defines and clarifies that the corporation can go ahead and make money. It can be a business. It can make profits, but it's going to be subject to the complete permission and control of the people, the state of the state itself, and which means the people. So let me just, I'm going through, here we are. Okay, page 331 in my book is where it begins. And we talk about the Move to Amend Coalition's work, and I actually quote, I have a word-for-word, I'm trying to get to the page, I said I had that thing ready to go, but here we are. It says, first it goes into why we have to do this. And
so it has a preamble, this amendment?
Yeah, it's actually there. You don't have the book. I'm looking, I'm almost there right now trying to find it, but...
That's all right. So just tell us what
it does. I'll get to it in just a minute as we go along with our conversation. And I've quoted it in here, you know. But the main two parts of it is that corporations are not natural persons with natural rights, and that speech is not money under the first, money is not speech under the First Amendment. So it actually says, here we go, I got it. You ready? It's on page 329.
All right, here we go. Let's hear it.
Here we go. Move to amend amendment calls the We the People Amendment, introduced as House Joint Resolution 29, on February 14, 2013, Section 1 says, artificial entities such as corporations do not have constitutional rights. The rights protected by the Constitution of the United States are the rights of natural persons only. Artificial entities established by the laws of any state, United States, or any foreign state shall have no rights under this Constitution and are subject to regulation by the people through federal, state, or local law. The privileges of artificial entities shall be determined by the people through federal, state, or local law, and shall not be construed to be inherent or inalienable. Section 2, money is not free speech. And that's just as important, by the way, as far as the people feel. So it says, federal, state, and local government shall regulate, limit, or prohibit contributions and expenditures, including a candidate's own contributions and expenditures, to ensure that all citizens, regardless of their economic status, have access to the political process, and that no person gains as a result of their money substantially more access or ability to influence in any way the election of any candidate for public office or any ballot measure. Federal, state, and local government shall require that any permissible contributions and expenditures be publicly disclosed. The judiciary shall not construe the spending of money to influence elections to be speech under the First Amendment. So there it is. It nullifies the Buckley versus Vallejo decision, and that is an extra important part because here you have these clean money elections, which Maine and Arizona pioneered, which we'll also talk about that as an alternative, as one of the options. Clean money elections in Maine and Arizona were pioneered in the late 90s, and it was adopted in Maine in 1988 for the first time, using the election. And that would require that an individual who wants to run for state assembly, let's say, would be able to gather $5 from 65 people who are registered to vote in his district, and that $5 per person would then be turned over as a nominating fee to the election commission, which then makes the individual candidate eligible to be put on the ballot immediately. And they put him on the ballot, and then the government writes him a check for several thousand dollars of public money in order to help him fund his election campaign. And as long as he or she pledges to not use any private money, not to get any private money, not to use his own private money even, only be a publicly funded candidate to that check the government writes. And then there were matching funds, Harvey, that allowed the clean money candidate to be able to catch up and be on the same playing field as the dirty money candidate, the private money candidate. If the private money candidate raised a lot of money, a lot more money than the clean money candidate, the government would write another check, a second check, and a third check to match the funds that would discourage the dirty money guy from trying to buy the election. It worked very well, and Maine actually elected 80% of its legislature almost immediately as clean money candidates, and Maine became the first state in the 2000, to implement a near comprehensive healthcare system without the influence of private insurance companies and lobbyists like HMOs and the other people who are involved with private healthcare. So Maine was able to, the legislature was able to free itself from the clutches of corporate money with the clean money election bill. But in Arizona, which followed suit, The U.S. Supreme Court recently struck down a portion of the Arizona bill, law, the Clean Money Act, which says that the matching funds are valid. But the U.S. Supreme Court recently said matching funds are invalid. They're not valid. They actually hurt the dirty money candidate, the private money candidate's free speech ability. Now, I don't know what the court was smoking or what it was smoking in the dollar bills that it was smoking while it made that decision again, saying that the man with the big money, the private money guy, is being hurt by a publicly financed candidate getting matching funds. It's just completely ridiculous, but they made that ruling, and that's why we need a 28th Amendment that would clarify this completely and allow complete public financing and real regulation.
Well, how do you plan to go about this now? I mean, obviously, this is a huge deal. It's got a. We did have laws limiting campaign contributions from corporations. This court has thrown out 100 years of legal precedent. So, how do you plan on doing this?
Well, we're planning on doing it.
What is the strategy for getting this into the Constitution?
But first, I'd like to give their website, movetoamend.org, which has all the details. They even have workshop kits for people around the country in how to organize house parties. And the idea here is to get as many voters to be conscious and to sign the pledge that they want clean, they want this 28th Amendment. And then that will be sent to their own members of the House of Representatives to and the Senate in their states to get them aboard and to get them to sign the pledge that they would actually be a co-sponsor and vote for it as a two-thirds majority vote in the House and Senate to actually propose the amendment formally. And they're also working with state legislators to get them to sign on saying they will actually vote to ratify the amendment once it's proposed. So it's a matter of getting the people to contact the politicians by signing pledges and actually getting the leaders to make pledges as well, and publicly. So this is a very, I think, it is very grassroots-oriented. There are 420-something thousand people in America who have signed that petition and hundreds of organizations that have joined the movement. So besides doing that, we're talking about real issues, about how once we have this campaign reform, corporate ownership reform, and we get this corporate personhood out, et cetera, then we can bring in the issues like having universal health care, not what we have with Obamacare, but a single-payer universal health care system. We can deal with issues, and we have to deal with the environmental issues right now without waiting for clean money or the 20th Amendment, but that will also help release us from the power and the clutches of agribusiness and the big corporations that are polluting our environment, causing global warming. So every single policy reform will be enhanced by having a 28th Amendment in place, and that's what this movement is doing, educating the public on.
All right, that's good. We're talking with a great radio host, and a professor and an author of a new book. Peter Matthews is author of Dollar Democracy, with Liberty and Justice for Some, How to Reclaim the American Dream for All. This is the Soartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. I'm Harvey Wasserman. Peter, so if we do this, if we stop or curtail or somehow control corporate giving, corporate bribing of our governmental structure, what happens next?
So what happens next is we free people to run for office and win who are really good people who care about the issues for the regular folks and for the whole country, not just for the top one half of 1%. These folks are then free to make policies like Senator Wellstone did, the single-player universal health care. He voted against the war in Iraq. Those policies that would really help us have a better, sustainable country and world, we can get those kind of people elected, Harvey, and that's what we're looking for from all levels, from city council to state assembly all the way through the United States Congress. And here's an interesting stat, Harvey. The CNN poll recently, about a week or two ago, came out that showed that almost two-thirds of Americans believe that the American dream has become impossible for most to achieve. And that's about a 10% increase since 2006. And two-thirds of Americans surveyed believe that most children in the United States will grow up to be worse off than their parents. That is a dire situation, and they're not so far off from their belief. Even older Americans, even more pessimistic, 70% say that kids won't do as well as the parents, 70% of the elderly people. So they already know what they live to, the golden age of people being able to grow a middle class and attain it. Even with one income, we could have a middle class lifestyle back in the 50s. And now with outsourcing, I mean, I've got a whole section in my book on Apple in China, where they contract with Taiwanese companies in China, which pay the workers to assemble the iPhone, only a little over a dollar an hour. They make these workers wake up at 3 in the morning, go to work. If it's an emergency request from Apple, they go to work for 10 hours a day for 7 days a week, and they don't even get breaks, hardly at all. The lunch break ends up being about 5 minutes in the end. It's just unbelievable what they're doing in Foxconn City, which I describe in detail. And Apple is making $400,000 profit per worker in the world, out of which all their workers, 700,000 workers, are outside the United States in third world or global south cheap countries, cheap labor countries, whereas only about 40,000 are in the United States. So Apple has outsourced all the manufacturing jobs to put together the iPad, the iPhone, those things that people understand are using and don't know how they're being made. This book will illuminate that, and I think a lot of people become morally conscious when they hear about that. Some of my students said, maybe the next phone I buy won't be an Apple. And I told them, hey, Samsung is doing the very similar thing right next door. So you got to find some way to do maybe a rolling boycott or something like that. But the main thing is to get the legislators to crack down on these corporations, get the Chinese government to raise the labor standards and environmental standards as well. And a lot of times we haven't been doing that, of course. Our corporate-led government has not been doing that.
Well, what do you want our corporate government to do? What's the message here?
First of all, I want them to get out of office if they're going to serve the corporation and not the people. And then secondly, if they are willing to change their ways, immediately I would say this government of the United States should do this at the federal level, is close all the corporate tax loopholes that are totally unproductive and unfair. For example, Facebook paid zero income tax in 2012 while making $1.2 billion in profit, and they received $400 million, a little bit over $400 million in corporate welfare that's handout from the government to promote themselves around the world. They ended up with a negative 40% tax burden. Apple hid $15 billion in taxes in offshore accounts with the offshoring loophole, and they were able to get this through campaign contributions. Oil companies have severance tax loopholes in California. They paid no severance tax here. Those loopholes should be closed at the state and federal level. You bring that money in for empowerment programs. First and foremost, put it into sustaining our environment, to creating renewable energy. We've got to move away from these fossil fuels, Harvey, as you have been spending your life preaching about. Nuclear power has got to go. Look at Germany. 50% or more of its energy comes from alternative energy, and that's an example. And the Germans have been putting cutting-edge research into it through government and the private sector. I want these politicians to start waking up here in America and doing the things that would help enhance our children's lives. I got a 2.5-year-old daughter, Paige. You know, what's her life going to be like? What will her college tuition cost be 15 years from now? What will the environment be like? And what about the West Coast and the whole world now, with Fukushima still pouring in that radiation? And we're finding it on the West Coast in fish, in some of the plants in the ocean. This is just so outrageous that these corporations are running roughshod, and they're going to end up, you know, not just killing us in the end. They'll themselves, the leaders of corporations, will also, they have to breathe the air, they have to drink the water, they have to go swimming. And if they don't have a long-range vision, it's time that the American people put our vision out there and get out there and really, that's what I want them to do, and the American people have to stand up and say that and demand it. Just like Frederick Douglass once said, power concedes nothing without a demand. Power concedes nothing without a demand, and that's where we, the people, have to demand this, Harvey, as you've been doing all these years with people working around you and with you.
Talking with Peter Matthews, author of Dollar Democracy. So, Peter, I take it you're a believer in direct democracy. And I mean, are you telling us what would you expect to happen if we actually do ban corporate money? What's your agenda? Let's say we ban corporate money, the democracy takes root in America, or reroute. What's going to happen next? What do you predict real democracy?
What we would have to work. Yes, we'd have to work toward, of course, and many people will be more engaged because now they'll see that their vote or their actual demonstration and rallying actually counts, and their meetings, at town hall meetings, will count. And what we have to work toward is a sustainable, socially just world, and it could be decentralized economics where you buy local, you encourage small businesses, you encourage farmers markets like we're doing right now. Our family goes to farmers markets and tries to buy organic as much as we can, non-GMO foods. And that's another issue. These big corporations like Monsanto have been completely spoiling our food with GMO crops and pesticides and Terminator seeds. This stuff's got to go. But once this dollar democracy is out of the democracy, the dollar's out of the democracy, we will have a lot of people engaged in a political way, in the highest term of the word politics, from the Greek word polis, which means community, city or community where people live. So to be political in the highest sense means for people to be involved directly in with and for the affairs of the community. I would say decentralized democracy, decentralized economics, and a concentric circle of communities in the United States and nations in the world that come together to cooperate on sustainable issues and social justice. anti-war.
All right. We're going to take a short break here, Peter, for about 3 minutes. We're talking with Peter Matthews, author of Dollar Democracy. When we come back, we're going to talk about imperialism. You use that dreaded word, imperialism, reminiscent of Karl Marx and all that stuff. So I want to talk about our foreign policy with you when you come back. We're at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. This is Harvey Wasserman. We're going to hear Dana Lyons sing the Solartopia Rocky Top version, and we'll be back in 3 minutes.
Coal plants, new plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Solartopia is home sweet home to me.
Thank you, Dana Lyons. Cows with Guns, Dana Lyons. Over 4 million views between the two sites. Take a look at it, my good buddy Dana Lyons, with the anthem of Solartopia, not to mention the anthem of the vegetarian movement.
Great
song. We are on with Peter Matthews, author of Dollar Democracy with Liberty and Justice for Some. Peter's a professor and ran for Congress a couple times. He was the Democratic nominee a couple times in Southern California. And now it's pushing this great book here. Tell us, you mentioned imperialism, that dreaded holdover word from the Marxist era, and I don't mean Groucho. tell us, Peter, what's the deal here? What's with our foreign policy, and how do the corporations interact with it?
Well, I'd love to use my friend Dr. Michael Parenti's definition. And by the way, we're having an event with him, a Great Minds event, right after you, in the end of August, on the 31st of August. But here it is. Parenti said that imperialism is the forced expropriation of the land, labor, and resources of one country by another. And, of course, the classical imperialism and colonialism, we know how it looked with Britain and India and France and Vietnam and Spain and Latin America, etc. You know, the people were forced to work under threat of military might. In fact, that sometimes they quite often got slaughtered if they didn't work, to extract and to grow food. To dig for gold, actually, and even raise tea in India, for example, cotton, to raise raw materials for the country that was the imperialist power, and to extract millions, if not, I mean, billions of dollars worth over the years, it's probably trillions of dollars worth of surplus value, of labor power, of the working people in the global south. And that's the main reason that the global south is so poor today, and it's continuing, this disparity is continuing with the global north, the wealthy countries like the United States and most of Western Europe and Japan, being able to set the terms of trade with the global south and force them to borrow and borrow more and more money. And the global south elites are in league with these elites, corporate elites here and globally, to go ahead and put their countries in more and more massive debt, reducing the standard of living of their people through free trade. And this I call it neo-imperialism now that's going on. It's a new form of imperialism, a far more effective one, extracting the resources while getting away with all kinds of things. And so it includes intervention where the U.S. goes in and, for example, in 1953, it went into Guatemala, and in 54 in Guatemala, and helped a military coup to overthrow the democratically elected president of Guatemala, Jacobo Arbenz, who was a person saying if he got elected, the people voted for him, he would take the unused land of the corporation, the United Fruit Company, and redistribute to the poor peasants to grow rice, beans, and corn. When he did that, the U.S. and the Guatemalan elite took action and got rid of him. bombed the presidential palace, and the U.S. put a dictatorship in there that lasted for years, for decades.
Now, what happened to Mr. Arbenz, personally? What happened to the this leader?
I think he was exiled at very least. I'm not sure. Was he killed in the process? Do you happen to know, Harvey?
I don't. I know Salvador Allende was killed in Chile. I do teach U.S. history, and what we describe our foreign policy, our attitude towards the rest of the world is that we allow the weaker, smaller countries to elect their own leaders, and then if we don't like those leaders, we kill them or remove them and tell the countries to try again. Would you say that's a reasonably accurate portrayal?
Absolutely accurate. It happened in 1954 in 53 in Iran with Mohammad Mossadegh, with the British Petroleum Corporation, and the U.S. getting involved with Operation Ajax to overthrow him and to put in the Shah. And all of this stuff comes back sometimes to bite us, we in the United States people, with a boomerang, as our man, the eminent international scholar, pointed out in his book Blowback. You know, and we're talking about these things are just hurting the people of the world, and it doesn't help our foreign policy or our security here. So this has got to stop, and we've got to find a new way. I would kind of use, you know, I'm not saying China is necessarily the best example of the anti-imperialist movement, but I would say the Chinese are using effectively what we call soft power, going around the world to some extent to be able to share resources with other countries, but then putting back to the other countries, helping them rebuild their infrastructure or build an infrastructure, building hospitals, schools, railroads, those things. So we don't do much of that. We've been instead demanding military bases, demanding corporate investments for our big multinational corporations instead with cheap labor and overthrowing governments that seek to bring about social justice. So we need to move away from that military option so much. And I was on NBC telling Bush during 2003 in a State of the Union address, do not go to war, Mr. President. This is wrong. It's illegal. And most importantly, it's illegal. It's unethical. But more as importantly, practically, we're getting access to all the inspection areas. The Saddam Hussein's letting us into those palaces of his where there could be weapons of mass destruction. And we are finding nothing. And yet he would never listen because we know what the agenda was ultimately, because as soon as we get in there, we start talking about privatizing the oil and bringing in foreign investors. This has got to stop, Harvey, because it's counterproductive, not only hurting millions of people in the world, it's also hurting our own people, our middle class, our working people, our young people going off to war because they can't afford college tuition. Why is that? Because the government stopped the subsidies. We used to have tuition-free education in California in 1960 to 1982 when Governor Pat Brown brought in the Master Plan for Higher Education. It was totally free. I started teaching in the late 70s in California. My students paid $6 for all 15 units in community college. At UC Berkeley, it was $37 for all 15 units at UC Berkeley Law School, where Governor Pete Wilson went. Governor Schwarzenegger went to Santa Monica College. So now these students can't get into college. They can't afford it. The classes have been cut. The section offerings are taking them so long to graduate. And therefore, a lot of them are saying, this may not be the best option. Let me go to the Army first. They volunteer. They end up in Iraq and Afghanistan for several tours of duty. They come back quite often with mental health problems. They come back maimed and injured. And this war in Iraq was a $3 trillion war. $3 trillion, that's what the book by Joseph Stiglitz. But it's actually more than that by now, because the interest on the borrowing alone has driven up the cost and put us so much in debt. So there's a moral dimension, of course, an ethical dimension, but also a very practical one. And I would say the Great Recession was partly brought on by these wars in the past that we have never paid for. We should never have been there in the first place. And we've got other reasons for the Great Recession as well that we could talk about. But this is what neo-imperialism is all about, and it's got to stop because we've got to have a much better world. And, Harvey, as you mentioned in one of the latest articles on Fukushima, this has got to be the number one issue right now. And I've said that about 6 months ago. I started showing my students Dr. Michio Kaku's analysis on television and their videos. I showed them even the ABC News had a coverage of that Fukushima situation that completely mirrored what Michio Kaku was saying. So it's not just left-wing radicals that are bringing up what's going on in Fukushima. This is the reality that's being covered up by a corporate media. And once we need to make that the top priority, but in the process, we also got to fight for these other things that we're talking about, you know. And neo-imperialism is not the way to go at all. It's devastating to our own people in the world. It only helps the 1% of the world that owns 80% of the wealth now.
Well, of course, we did have a period in the New Deal with Franklin Roosevelt where we had a good neighbor policy in Latin America, and that had tremendous benefits for us. And in fact, in 1938, the Mexican government nationalized the oil resources in right. Mexico set up Pemex and a national oil company, and the world was astounded when the United States did not invade.
Did not intervene, yeah.
what a shocker, But it paid off
immediately
it paid off immediately because we were then attacked by Germany, by Japan, and then, of course, got into the war with Germany. And we didn't have to worry about our southern border. There was, you know, a lot of tension on our southern border during World War One, because Woodrow Wilson had so alienated Mexico with his invasions. And God forbid, had Franklin Roosevelt done that prior to World War II, we might well have been facing some problems on our southern border, which was
certainly the last thing
we needed.
Exactly. And I totally agree with you about the Roosevelt policy. That was quite different than the previous ones. I also really, in my book, give you a good extensive analysis of what should be done. We need a new type of New Deal, a modern-day New Deal today, to invest in public sector, rebuild infrastructure, but also to create public sector jobs and even rehire some of the folks who have been laid off, like teachers and community-based police and firefighters. There's been tremendous cuts right now. So FDR could even show us the way in the domestic arena as well as foreign policy to some extent.
Right. Well, I would rely on his wife, Eleanor, but nonetheless,
she was the one, really.
the team did it. So, Peter, you've got a pretty expansive view here. Talk to us about big agribusiness, pesticides, and GMO. What's your take on that?
Oh, my take on that is these huge agricultural corporations like Monsanto and Archer Daniels Midland have completely captured our government. They get huge subsidies from the U.S. government, and they also get deregulation, which allows them to put out all kinds of food, including GMO seeds and foods that are really, really injurious to our health. If you go to the Institute for Responsible Technology, that's IRT.org, they have a great website. It's headed by a man named Jeffrey Smith, who wrote a book called Seeds of Deception. It's the best analysis I've seen with scientific evidence, surveying the literature, doing their own experiments, finding out how some of the experiments and research was flawed, and much of it was paid for by the industry to make it look like GMO foods don't hurt us. In reality, they hurt us tremendously. And so these corporations have been able to bamboozle and brainwash the people. Now Americans are waking up, and Vermont became the first state, as you know, to require labeling of GMO foods. And when it did that, Monsanto immediately said they're going to sue Vermont. So we're trying to help Vermont by making sure they have enough money to withstand the lawsuit. And we want that labeling GMO policy in California, which, by the way, got defeated in 2012. Prop 37, led by...
How did that happen? How did that GMO thing get beat in California? It's shocking.
Can you believe this, Harvey? The polls were showing as late as October, beginning of October, that the Prop 37 that would have required the labeling of these GMOs was ahead by a 2-to-1 margin. And yet, at the end, and the people who were supporting Prop 37 had a lot of volunteers. They had some funding as well. They put it on the ballot by getting millions of signatures. But in the end, even though we were ahead in the conscience of the public, what happened was these big companies, Monsanto, DuPont, and a few others, put in a total of $46 million against about $7 million that the pro-labeling side had, and just put out disinformation, outright lies, and scared the people into thinking their food bills are going to skyrocket if we have to require labeling. And that's how they defeated it by just, you know how much, Harvey? 48-point-something% is what our side got, and their side got 51-point-something%.
Well, that's within the range of theft. There's no doubt about that. That could have been stolen, as was, I think, there was a gay marriage amendment, too, when that got stolen. So are people going to try again in California to force the labeling of GMO food?
Absolutely. In fact, this movement, which I'm also working with, and Pam Larry was a state leader on that Prop 37, and we have Moms Across America and Kathleen Halal and Zen Honeycutt to help co-found that group. Thousands of moms across America getting the word out about GMOs and what it does to their children and how they were able to get their children off of the GMO foods and those sickening elements went away. So these moms, you know, across America and the Label GMOs Coalition have been trying to get the government, they're lobbying it through the state legislature now to get them to pass a labeling bill. But they were just set back a little bit again because of corporate lobbyists. This Assembly or Senate Agricultural Committee is heavily influenced by corporate farmers, and the bill was killed there. They couldn't get the extra vote, two votes more, one more vote that they needed to pass it through the committee and get it to the floor. It didn't make it. So when you go through the established system, quite often there are so many defeats because of the corporate lobbyists and the dollar democracy. But these folks have not given up. If you go to their website, labelgmos.org, they're still moving strong for the next phase, which possibly can be another initiative once again.
Okay. Talk to us now about the healthcare. Your book has a whole chapter on healthcare, managing the healthcare system without single payer. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. And this Obamacare is a very, very small step in the right direction, and at least it has the goal of universal care ultimately. But even Obamacare, which decided to make a deal with the health insurance lobbies and the corporate insurance companies and HMOs, Obama said, I'm not going to suffer the defeat that Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton did, so I'm going to go ahead and work with the guys already in power. Let's let them keep their private health care businesses, let them make profits, but we'll regulate them somewhat and make a few rules about whom they have to cover. So Obamacare, of course, as you know, doesn't allow the insurance companies to deny people because of pre-existing conditions, and also allows students to stay on their parents' health care for a few more years if they're in college. Those kinds of miniature reforms, which are really significant for certain numbers of people, it really helped, is just certainly not even enough, Harvey. For example, even when Obamacare is finally implemented, according to plan, if it ever does get fully implemented without these nicks and bruises they're trying to inflict on it, what will happen is it'll still leave 20 million Americans uncovered. It seeks to cover 15 million Americans, but it only says it can do 30 million, and 20 will be, out of the 50 will be left uncovered even while it's finally implemented. And that's a problem. Not only that, there's no cost containment, real cost containment, and the health care inflation keeps going up and up. It was 12% per year. Last year it was 4%, only because in California there's an initiative coming on the ballot that will allow the insurance commissioner to even put stricter regulations. So the industry is trying to keep their costs down, but they're still charging 4% more this year. That kind of inflation, it's two or three times the inflation rates that we have on the general level. That cannot be sustained. Not only that, even those who do have health care coverage under the Obamacare plan have tremendous amount of co-payments and deductibles. I had a friend whose mom, sir, and then they had to pay a $30,000 co-payment for a treatment, and they couldn't fix the roof on their house. They left the roof leaking throughout the whole winter. That was only something that you could imagine. Other people who went broke and lost their home because they couldn't make the co-payments. And medical care's lack of coverage and the co-payments have caused personal bankruptcies. 60% of bankruptcies in America are due to medical costs out of control, especially the co-payments and deductibles. So I would say that Obama should have stuck to his guns on requiring a public option, which would have been a type of single-payer alternative to private health care that people could choose from. They could go to the public option or keep their private insurance. That would have been a much better step in the right direction. But ultimately, I would like to see, in fact, immediately, hopefully, is a complete single-payer universal health care system, Medicare for all. Simple. Just extend Medicare to everyone, bring the premiums into the Medicare system, and in Canada, it works very well. It's about two-thirds the cost to cover everyone, and no co-payments, no deductibles in Canada generally. Prescription drug benefits are like prescription drugs at half the price of what they are here. And don't forget, here's dollar democracy. In George Bush's administration that brought in prescription drug benefit, they insisted, and the Bush administration insisted, that Medicare would not be able to bargain with the drug companies to lower the price of drugs. So that's why our prescription drugs are twice the cost of the Canadian ones, which are susceptible, which actually are regulated through bargaining power of the Medicare system. But that was because the big players of the big pharma was able to lobby Congress and lobby Bush to put that provision in there. And so the people suffer, and the top 1% gets more money out of it. And Billy Tozen, the congressman from Louisiana, who served and carried the water for these insurance and big pharma for years and years, when he retired a few years ago, they appointed him to be their top lobbyist at $2 million a year, the revolving door. So to me, it goes back to the philosophical question. Is health care a human right to be guaranteed to all, or is it a privilege that has to be earned individually by you working yourself for it and paying for it privately? And to me, it's a no-brainer. Health care is tied to the right to life, the right to pursuit of happiness, as in our declaration. You cannot pursue your fulfillment and happiness without having good health. You certainly can't have a good life without having health care guaranteed. It's not only is it ethically required, in my view, to have a guaranteed health care system for all, but it's also practical. One more thing, Harvey, on the practical side. You know, it costs $1,000 more to build a car in the United States than in Canada. To build the same car in Canada, it's $1,000 less because the government covers the health care costs, whereas over here, In the auto industries, most of them are still covering health care and cost them $1,000 more in the premiums per person. And even increasingly, they're dropping people from health care coverage. So it's becoming untenable. The Obamacare will not do the full job like it should. And I think we have to push the president and Congress to go quickly in the direction toward public option, at least in single-payer health care, preferably.
Well, that's we're talking with Peter Matthews here, author of Dollar Democracy. Peter, you've covered a wide range of issues here. Tell us now, we've only got a few minutes left, unfortunately. Talk to us about education. You've got a chapter called Dismantling Public Schools and Colleges for the 99%. Tell us all about that. As an adjunct professor, I'm a fellow traveler in this situation, and I want to hear what you got to say.
And I have the experience in both areas. I taught adjunct for 10 years before I got my full-time job, and today I teach full-time and adjunct at a different college. So I'm in both shoes. I know exactly how people are, what they're going through. But to start with, education K-12 in the United States has a basic flaw. It is funded primarily by property taxes, which means the wealthier areas where wealthier people live have higher property value property, and they pay, therefore, more dollars in taxes. And that money comes back in those school districts in those wealthier areas in very, very generous per-pupil spending. For example, in Marin County, a very wealthy area in Northern California, the per-pupil spending is $18,000, Harvey, per pupil. Down in Southgate, a lower-income area of Los Angeles, it's $7,000 per student. In Long Beach, it's $9,000 per student in our district here. And that disparity, and if you go between states, in New York, the average is $17,000 per student statewide. In California, it's $8,500 per student statewide. So the disparity between among school districts within the state and also among states is untenable because it is not an even playing field. It doesn't guarantee all the students the right to be able to have a God-given or a nature-given education, develop their nature-given talents or God-given talents fully. And you see the research I found, my sociological work, and all the literature in it shows that the biggest predictor of whether a child in America will be successful in school, K-12, and on to college and university, and or in life, because a lot of it's tied to economics, is the parental income, Harvey. The lower-income parents, as much as they love their children, just like any other income parents do, they just don't have the opportunity for their children because they don't have the time, for one thing. They're working double time to work overtime, make ends meet. Quite often, and so the children's homework may suffer. There's no homework after-school programs like they should have or like the rich parents can pay for. The wealthier parents can pay for arts programs for their kids after school, homework programs. They can also have a bigger vocabulary the students come in contact with in the upper-income areas to give them a better head start in life in speaking the language. All of these disparities are due to economic disparities, the gap between rich and poor. That's why the biggest change has to be in the economy, to narrow that gap, to bring up people's incomes and wages. But meanwhile, I suggest in my book that we go to a type of program that they have in Cambridge, England. When I taught semester abroad for Cypress College at Cambridge, I visited a youth center where in the lower income, it's actually the center of the city of Cambridge, and it doesn't matter what income you belong to, you could come to this youth center, which was magnificent, Harvey. The center would be open from 2 o'clock in the afternoon till 10 o'clock at night during the week, and they provided in the center adult mentors or professionals who wanted to come and help the children learn. They had academic programs there, tutoring, but they also had Battle of the Bands. They had fashion design, fashion merchandising. They had contests, and these young people just flourished. And it wasn't just low-income children who went there, but even the middle to higher-income children would go because the programs were so great. And on weekends, it was open from 10 o'clock in the morning till about midnight, so even longer time on weekends. And if parents are not always there or can't be there for their children, they have this alternative type sustaining environment that is just tremendous in opening up children's minds and talents. We need those youth centers all over the United States, especially in the lower income areas, both the inner city and in the rural areas, which are low income areas as well. And that would make a difference. But meanwhile, we can't lose sight of the goal that this capitalist system is one of the most unequal systems in history. The gap between rich and poor in America has grown. In 1980, before Reagan came in, it was 40-1. The income gap between the average CEO's income and the average worker was 40-1. Today, it is 400-1, Harvey. And the top 400 families in America, the richest 400 families, own the same amount of wealth as the bottom 150 million Americans, half the country. Can you imagine that disparity? And that's causing these problems in education, in our schools, in environmental injustice. I mean, you look at little children living in my book, Toxin. I have real-life stories in there, which really brings alive these concepts, these academic intellectual concepts are put to real life. And I have children growing up near the harbor in L.A. who are suffering asthma rates you would not believe. There are cancer clusters over there from the emissions of all these cars and trucks and diesel, that including dirty diesel still. So the environmental injustice is also correlated with economic injustice. And all of this has to be addressed, and we can't do it till we get dollars out of democracy. That's what this book is about, Harvey.
Well, listen, Peter, real quickly, though,
colleges. You got a second. Colleges have to be brought back to where it's free of individual charge, like we had in California and like they have in other parts of Europe today.
Peter Matthews, we got to wrap up now. Give us a couple of final words here for our very compelling, and it's been a pleasure to hear you speak. You're incredibly articulate. Tell us, please, if you have one message, and give us your website and your book titles for people to go to so we can wrap this up.
My message is let's restore and reclaim the American dream for everyone and make this opportunity available throughout the world. Let's start in our own home country right here. And to do that, we have to get involved politically and take the dollars out of democracy. And my website is epetermatthews.com, and Matthews is spelled with one T, M-A-T-H-E-W-S, epetermatthews.com. They can go there, and they can click on the Amazon link to buy it from Amazon, or just click on my link, and I can send them a signed copy, or they can go to Barnes & Noble. Believe they're carrying it also, and so are your, but go to your neighborhood bookstore, the independent business bookstore. They also have access to my book. It'll be
all right.
A pleasure,
Peter Matthews,
talking to Harvey.
And I look forward to seeing you in California next week. And Peter Matthews, you've been a great guest. Your book is Dollar Democracy. Tell us real quickly in the last second about the move to amend and where people can get in contact with this amendment to take money out of politics.
Yes, people can go to move to amend.
Go ahead, really fast.
Move to amend.org.
Move to amend.org. Peter Matthews, your book is Dollar Democracy. Thanks so much for being with us. This has been another great Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. We'll see you next week.
Solartopia, Solartopia, don't you know?